Hi, HR Nation. Welcome back to another episode of the HR Leaders Podcast, the show where we explore the future of work with industry experts and HR executives from the world's leading global brands. Today, I have a special guest on the show. I'm super excited to introduce all of you to Liz Kislick. Great name, Liz, by the way. It's the name of my mum. I didn't mention that beforehand, so you've already got points there. Liz is a global executive management and leadership coach. She's a TED speaker. She's also a frequent contributor to publications like the Harvard Business Review and Forbes. The list goes on, but I'll let Liz do more talking about that. Welcome to the show, Liz. How are you?
Chris, I'm so happy to be with you. And it is amazing how we will look for any point of commonality.
Yeah, I know, Liz, Elizabeth. Did anyone call you Elizabeth? Or is it you're like, no, call me Liz.
now it's really call me Liz. You know, doctors, of course, call me Elizabeth because of the health insurance. But yeah, it's call me Liz.
My mom's like that as well. My mom's like, don't call me Elizabeth. But it's weird because I'm Christopher and not Chris. But so the only time I get called Christopher is when I'm in trouble. So when my mum's telling me off, or my wife, my mum calls me Christopher. There's a few people in my life that call me Christopher, only a few, but normally it's when I'm in trouble. Does something, Christopher? I'm like, oh no, what have I done this time? Love it. Tell everyone a little bit more about you. I gave kind of a very brief intro, but your whole journey and story and what you do is fascinating. So give everyone sort of a high level overview.
Okay, so I have had my current practice for over 30 years, and it's been an evolution. When I got out of college, I wanted to work rather than going to grad school, which is what most of my friends were doing, because I liked being where the action was, you know? And I went to work for a marketing company that I had worked for a couple of summers, because that's where I got the best deal, because they already knew me. And most of my jobs there were almost a surprise. I got promoted every 6 months because I was always looking for what else could be done, basically. And so after a while, they would recognize that I was doing some other piece of work and would promote me into it. And by the time I was 23, I was a vice president and running a 300-person call center.
Oh, wow. You really did. So you're used to the headset right now.
So in fact, that's so funny, Chris, because I wouldn't wear one then.
Oh, really? Why not? Because
I'll tell you.
Ruined my hair.
No. Curly hair, you don't
have
to worry.
I'm joking.
The issue was that in those days, it was long enough ago that headsets were still a rare and expensive thing.
I remember even when I started, it was like only the top executives or people got one. It was so expensive, like £400-£500 for a headset. Yeah, I'm with you.
And I felt like I didn't want the customer on my head. You know, they were just too close to me. It was too much.
I get it.
Yeah. So the idea of being able to gently hang up and separate myself.
I love that. Yeah.
That was really important to me. Now, you know, if I weren't using a headset all those years of phone,
you know, the young generation has no idea what you just did there.
Oh, sorry.
No. I'm just, no, but you know what I mean. No one, like, if I try and explain to my daughter when she's older, we used to do this with our shoulder and hold the phone between our jaw and our ear and our shoulder. They're like, what are you doing?
Right.
Sorry.
You're absolutely
it's a little moment there that only us with wired phones back in the day can relate to.
Yeah. it's the idea of hanging up.
Yes, exactly. That physically hanging up.
Which was important to me, but. Yeah, so that was really, really hard. I was probably too young to do that.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I learned so much and I stressed so much. And I did a bunch of other things in the time that I was there. And when I left there, I was well known in the industry for that kind of management, for customer service, that sort of thing. And so there were consultants in the field who subcontracted to me right away. So I didn't even have a week off from when I left to when I got started.
Was that for your own company, though?
That was for my own company.
So yeah, you left there and said, rather than going somewhere else, let me just do this myself.
Yes. Okay. Exactly so. I always had a boss, but I never
acted as if you had one.
I never
operated. We share so much in common, by the way. So just a quick story before you go any further. So I started my job at 17 in a sales call center. By the time I was 23, I was managing a sales call center team of about 15 to 20. Obviously, it fluctuated as sales does with people coming in and out as well. I did that for 10 years. And then I started this company because I didn't. So we have some commonalities there.
Exactly.
So I completely relate to when you mentioned the headset and stuff like that. And like getting my headset was like a big deal. And I also requested the wireless one because I didn't want to be attached to my desk. For the same reason you didn't want to be attached to your headset was kind of the same mentality for me, that I didn't want to be attached to the idea that I have to be stuck to this physical piece of wood, this desk, was annoying. So I used to walk all around the office doing my calls, and I used to have my pitch folder in my hand, and I used to, even just walk around with the team and just not be attached to it. So in a different way.
So I would say that we both like autonomy.
Oh, a lot. Yes.
Right. And that's why, although I was certainly respectful and deferential to the people who were my bosses, often I came up with what needed to be done and handled it myself and those kinds of things. So when it was time to go off on my own, of course it was scary, but it was only reasonably scary.
Well, because you've done that, and the same way I did, I treated my HR portfolio of events, which is what I did. It was an events company, as if I owned it. Literally, the entire thing. To the point where even though I had a marketing team, we created our own marketing strategy and our own system, even though we had one in the company. And even to the point where I requested that my team be removed off the main sales floor where we had hundreds of people, because I wanted to create my own subculture and create, because I didn't agree with the way that the company was running it. And so I was clashing heads a little bit, don't get me wrong, because I didn't necessarily always agree with the status quo. If anything, I was always challenging the status quo. Why we do it. It's like, oh, we just do it because that's how we do it, Chris. For me, that wasn't a good enough reason of why of why we should do that. And in the end, and I'll let you go back to your comment, your story, I left because of that, because I was so frustrated by constantly banging my head against the wall or not being listened to, our customer not being listened to, that I created my own company. So if you're not going to do it here, and you're not listening to the customer, I'm going to go do it somewhere else on my own. So that was kind of where it kind of came to.
So where we really are in parallel is this idea of on my own. Mm. What I learned was that my independence was really important to me.
Yeah.
And as a consultant, I could pick and choose my jobs.
Yes. Yeah.
And if I picked a job and it turned out that I didn't like the way they ran their business, I would make good on my commitments, but I didn't have to re-up. I could leave. And that has always been important and valuable to me. I worked with one client, I don't know why this comes to mind. Every time I would go there, this was in the days where you always went there, wherever it was, I would travel around the country. And whenever I went to their offices, there was somebody in the reception area crying. And it wasn't that they had come from a funeral or whatever. It's that they were crying because they were so upset. And after you've been to a place a half a dozen times and every time somebody's crying, you start to think maybe this is not the place to be.
Yeah. No, and that was the kind of company I worked in as well. Just fast track everyone. How did you go from managing the call center to being one of the most sought after global executive management leadership coaches in the world? Because you've kind of missed that gap in between for everyone as well.
Gee, I wouldn't have described myself in that way exactly. Although thank you, I take it as a promotion. I think all that really happened, Chris, is I just followed my own lights. And so what I've always done, in the way you talked about how you approach things. I've always been very analytical about what's working, what's not working. Where are the leverage points where we could make something better? Can I get people engaged in doing that? Mm-hmm. What can we experiment with? How can we make it better? And to a great extent, how can we talk about both the issue and our determination of what we need to do in ways that people really understand what's going on and can express their own views so we're getting the best of everybody? Mm-hmm. And although I started out by doing that work in client call centers, when there were leaders who were willing to hear about the rest of their business, I could tell them something, because even on the sales side, as opposed to the service side, anything that goes wrong in the organization ends up affecting a customer somehow. They're not treated well, the documentation doesn't work, the product or the way it's shipped, there's some problem. All these things happen. And so you really learn about what's going on in the business based on what customers say.
Yeah.
So I would be able to give feedback to the leadership about other aspects of the business. And over time, that was more and more desirable for a number of clients. And so my work evolved into everything from business strategy to leadership development. It was really all about the organization then.
Love that.
And making sure that the work was good, because that's how you retain people and how you attract people. And so I've been doing it ever since. And it differs by organization. What I probably like the best is working in privately held companies. I work for a lot of family businesses, because when something isn't the way that would be best, you can cut through the bureaucracy and get to the owner or senior leader. And either they want to support the thing that I think is right, or they don't. And so then you know, either you can work on it or you can move on.
Yeah. I'm literally had to go through that process a few months ago with Chester Elton, who's my coach. And, we did, you know, our 360 with the team and got feedback and et cetera. And it was hard, you know, to hear things I need to improve and go on that journey. And, you know, for my founder as well. And even my own wife was actually part of that process, because I asked her, which is quite unconventional, I'm told.
That's great.
But I was like, I want to hear it all as well. But you're right. You can definitely get through a lot of the red tape and bureaucracy that you typically have to in the smaller, you know, business, and really make change happen. Quickly as well. And I'm still not perfect, still got a long way to go. I'm learning. Yeah, exactly. I'm still making mistakes, but I'm realizing that it's part of the process. I want to jump in then. You've written some amazing articles, which is one of the reasons I was also excited to talk to you. So definitely, for everyone listening, follow Liz on LinkedIn. The link to her LinkedIn profile is below, and also her website already in the description, so make sure you click on that. There's a couple of things I want to jump in. The first one, which is something I'm hearing constantly from our leaders, is, you know, how do we create, a flex work policy when everyone has different needs? And I don't think we're all trying to solve this problem. as well. And then also, what challenges is that presenting leaders and managers in organizations?
Isn't it so interesting how the pandemic really forced us to learn how different people's needs were?
Yeah.
There were ways we could ignore it before, because it used to be that employees basically had to accommodate themselves
to whatever the business, you just had to. There wasn't even a question of,
right?
Can I? That's just how it is.
No, everybody just knew you had to suck it up. And now people understand there are so many ways to work that are actually productive. And yet, there are circumstances in which there is loss if we can't be together. And part of what's so interesting about this is, you know, even 5 years ago, there were global businesses, and somehow they managed not to spin apart. They did manage to stay in touch with each other and have the meetings they needed.
This episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. 2/3 of employees have 1 foot out the door in 2024. And the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
So we shouldn't have gotten so stressed out. We should realize there are ways to make this work. Mm-hmm. But the first thing is really understanding what people need, but without saying to them, anything goes. Do whatever you want. As soon as you say, do everything you need, do everything you want to everybody, it's very hard to ever bring it back again. And as a leader, part of what you're responsible for is providing actual direction and setting the tone and the context. So understanding what works best for people doesn't mean knowing every single little thing that bothers them. You know, sometimes we go too far and try to understand too much. But what are the major constraints? What are the schedules or timing that would work best for you? And let's see how much of that we can accommodate. And then after you've studied all of that, thinking about how can you serve the majority and where do you need to create exceptions? Because we always had exceptions.
We just didn't talk about it, right? Because you don't want to tell anyone else. Don't tell them. Don't tell anyone else you're doing that.
Right. But that means it's scary and it's protected and it's secret.
Yes.
And as soon as you have secrets, you've suddenly built things into more than they actually are. The very act of creating secrets makes it a heavier deal. You know, that we will help you with whatever your circumstances are, a child at home, an elderly parent, your, forgive me, this sounds terrible, but your dog is dying and that's important to you. When those, any of those kinds of things happen, it behooves a business to adjust some portion of the way. My mother used to say something about not being so open-minded, your brains fall out. So you don't want to give up all strictures, but you want to be flexible so that people have their real lives and appreciate you for supporting that, because that's part of how you retain them when there are so many jobs that people could go to if they wanted something besides you.
Yeah. I think that's the fear, though. You just kind of hit at the end, right? Is that managers seem to be so fearful of not adhering to exactly what every individual wants because there's this, they don't want to lose them. But at the same time, they're being told from their leadership that the, you know, the new policy is that every one of your team members have to be in twice a week. So they're kind of like stuck in this middle ground of, I'm being told that we, my team now has to be twice a week, but now as a manager, and by the way, this is a new skill and a new, no one's had to go through this before. This is a brand new thing, right? Of managing, you know, hybrid teams as you know, other people have done it, you're right. But I mean, on scale that we're seeing now, no, it's kind of unheard of as well. So I've got managers saying, Chris, I've got, you know, two of my team members that just refuse to come in on the Monday when everyone comes in. What am I supposed to do? Do I just fire them? They're just refusing to come in. And but I've been told by HR that they need to be in twice a week.
Right. Okay. So let's break this out into the different issues. One of the things is have to be in twice a week. Well, why? And for what? Is it just to prove that they still work here? Well, they can prove that in lots of other ways, like by delivering their actual outputs. If we gauge people's performance and value by their actual behavior and what they do in their work, that should be, it isn't always, but it should be some comfort to most leaders. Who sets the 2 days? Why is it? Why does it have to be 2 days and the same days for the whole company? At least maybe there could be leeway among teams. does coming, do we need to actually be physically present for all activities that are of a certain kind? So that's one piece. There are lots of questions, and it helps to actually go through them all. The other piece is, why would someone actually refuse? Why would someone say, if I have to come in at all, I'll never come in again? That's a drastic statement. Maybe they don't actually value this job, and it's only worth it if it's easy for them and they don't have to accommodate. Well, that's a very important thing to know if they're not committed to the organization. Maybe their life has changed in some particular way that actually they can't come in anymore. So then you have to figure out, is it worth keeping them? The thing is not to react right away. This kind of whipsawing of it's too much, it's too little, it has to be all this way, forget you. Come to a meeting of the minds. You don't always have to meet in the middle. Maybe they can come in one day. Maybe the issue is a particular team meeting. There's an operations meeting on Monday and everybody has to be there. Well, maybe that meeting can be a hybrid meeting and there are other times they can come in for other functions. Usually, I tell leaders that they shouldn't be so much in the weeds, or what I call not only losing the forest for the trees, but staring at the bark. Okay. I tell them not to be in that place. But this is one where somebody has to be in the weeds and actually understand why, and on both sides of the equation. And then you work toward a kind of negotiated medium.
And that's the thing, though. There has to be a give and take, right? Because it can't be one or the other. And that's where we're seeing on both sides. You've got employers saying our way or no way. And then you've got the employees saying that. And I think it's on those line managers to have these quite tough conversations who perhaps necessarily don't have the skills, the language, the training to have that. Because
spot on.
When have they ever had that opportunity? And also, even when you do come to an agreement, people's lives change.
Yes.
And also, that person may say to you, I want to work remote full time, and realize 2 months later, no, actually, I don't want to work at home full time and I want to come in the office. So before it was binary, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, you got to be there. When we talk about hybrid or flexible working, when I think flexible, I mean constantly flexible. That person may have a kid and now that changes. So as you said, a parent may get old, that changes. It's a constant dialogue, I think, that has to be coming, as opposed to this is our process of how it works. Because people's lives change along the way.
You know what came to my mind? We need to stop thinking of the resource part and think more of the human part.
Exactly.
You know, it's not just plug and play. And you would think that with all we've been through and fear of death in so many ways, that we would be more patient with each other about what's this new transitional stage. The idea that leaders would now be legislating must be 2 days a week, no matter what. Job, you know, just absolute conditions of maintaining employment. Without digging into what does that mean at the individual level, well, that's just really arbitrary. And arbitrariness, I think, comes from older models that don't work anymore. They actually don't work anymore.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll share my story because it's happened to me recently. It's in my wife's company. I've just decided that she has to be back 2 days a week. And she's literally going, you know, an hour commute to open her laptop and carry on, do the exact same thing that she does at home. And the stress that's caused on our relationship for childcare and me now having to completely rework my schedule, and both of us, to be honest, in order to be there to to pick up and drop off my daughter at nursery. It just caused so much stress, even yesterday, to the point where I was like, oh my God, I've got to pick up Robin today. Because I just, I'm not used to having to do that every day, like, you know, on those particular days. And there's no payoff. It's different if she was going there to meet her team and collaborate and, you know, like all of the things that some of the things that you mentioned as well, right? That's fine. Like, that makes sense. If there's same reason my team comes in every Monday and we collaborate and it's not sitting there on computers, it's talking about project deliveries and, you know, getting our minds going, you know, the ideas going. And there's no reason. I was like, have you asked? Obviously, I would say this. Have you asked your manager, you know, why? And it's basically, the answer is because we said so.
Right.
And it just drives me insane. And unfortunately, that's like most of my entire friendship circle. This isn't the few, this is the majority, which is really, as you said, after the last 2 years we've had, seems so counterintuitive. Because we have such an amazing opportunity. We have such an amazing opportunity right now to rethink how we work and how work gets done. And unfortunately, I'm seeing companies slowly but surely slip back into old ways.
Yes. Look, as humans, we have a kind of set point for expectations. And when you move us, even as we are trying to be better ourselves, particularly under stress, we're likely to revert. We return at least part of the way to where we were. You can see that. I've been in Manhattan a number of times, and you can see that even to the extent, it's funny measure, that women are back to wearing high heels. Not all of them. But 6 months ago, nobody wore high heels, you know?
That's a really interesting one, yeah.
you see it, and that's a measure to me of returning to the old way. So I'm going to add another thing to your wife's circumstance. Not only has it disrupted the logistics of your home life as you've been dealing with them, but it also says to her, in a way, I'm sorry to make this worse, we don't value your commuting time. That's on you. We want to see your laptop open. Well, how does that make the person feel? It's not just that it's inconvenient. It's like, isn't my time valuable? Shouldn't I be able to be productive in a way that makes me productive on your behalf? In an odd way, we are asking people to be less creative, to go back to being mindless. That's a terrible thing to ask of a fellow human being. So why are people doing it? Why is this happening?
Yeah. What advice would you give to HR teams then who are battling with other leaders who really want that, what we're describing, but many, you know, I would say the vast majority, if not like, of HRs I speak to agree with our sentiment, right? But yet they're having to battle with their CEO, their leadership team, and who don't, you know, any advice would you give to them about how to really help that conversation and hopefully even come to a middle ground with their own organization?
Good. So I'm going to, I think, break this into three sections. The first one is make the business case. What is the data that you can bring to bear about retention or turnover or productivity that shows how productive people have been at home and why this works? And there's plenty of public data now about how companies who demanded everybody be back then lost people. You know, you can find data about what the preferences are and how people are operating. So be able to make the business case, but that's not enough, because those leaders could be reading the same research and data themselves. But you need it as backup. You cannot go without it. You have to show why, in both short and long term, this is better. Second thing is you need what I call the warm puppy. You need an example that will be compelling to your leadership about, given that data, and here is our person that this affects that I know you want to keep.
Oh, so that's a good one. Something like a really high, you know, someone that, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
High performer.
You do not make this case for your biggest complainer, laggard, has always been a problem.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You make the case for somebody who is beloved, respected, a real mover, any of those things. And then, you know, you want it to feel like it will hurt to lose that person. Okay. Those two are logical. Then you have this illogical piece, which goes back to the point of why does the senior leader truly believe this is the only way to run the business? And that's where you kind of have to run a set of diagnostics on that person or those people. What are the beliefs about themselves that they are satisfying by requiring people to be in the office? There are quite a number of leaders, and surprisingly, they are not all older, who actually believe that work isn't work if you're not in the workplace. They're not exerting the leaderliness that they believe in for themselves if they're not in front of their people. Some of it is they may need new skills themselves. Maybe they hate video meetings and you have to work on ways to show them that it's okay.
Like we just discussed, it's hard. Like managing a high-risk team is harder than having everyone in person. Of course it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But also that people will regard them better. You know, if you feel that there is some person in a suit, in a corner office, who is forcing you to have a bad life to keep your job. So isn't the interesting thing, like a big secret, that always existed, right?
We already had that, yeah.
We always had that feeling, that tension, but now there's more power on the part of employees. So just telling the leader, this is what you're going to lose, they may deny it. They may not believe you because it doesn't fit their worldview. So you really have to get in their heads.
This is what this means for you. You need to kind of represent that case as well.
Mm. Yes, yes. And where you can, find them examples that are compelling to them. Sometimes you'll know, for example, that this leader tracks what the competition does. So if you can find out that the competition is managing hybrid, use that as an example.
This is when it's about knowing your leaders, right?
Mm. Very much so.
And what makes them tick? Yeah.
Mm. If HR doesn't know that, get on the case right away.
Yeah, most great HR leaders, that's their number. Like, you know, when they join a business, I'm like, what did you do for the first 6 months? I sat down with every single leader, Chris, and understood how they operate, what's valuable to them. And really understood, because before implementing any type of strategy and change, if you don't know that and you don't have the trust and the insights on all of those leaders, you're going to fail every time as well. So yeah, definitely. I love that advice. That kind of goes on to the next question then. Anything else you wanted to add to that?
That's good.
That's good. That's more than enough. You did also do an article on what's on the top leadership lessons that come out of the pandemic. Is there any that we've missed that you wanted to highlight on from that point of view?
Oh, goodness. Okay. So what I'll say today, and exactly to your point before, Chris, I'm changing my mind every few weeks, you know, because as you learn more, incorporate it. There's no reason to get stuck with where we were 6 months ago as if life is now over and it's a tidy package and it's never changing. We're learning more all the time. Mm-hmm. So some of the lessons from the pandemic are really around flexibility and what advantage can we take of flexibility. What we learned is we could make sudden terrible changes and survive, you know, and figure out how to get everybody at home and hook them up and all of that. Well, if we can make that kind of change under pressure, shouldn't we be able to make change when we're not under quite as much pressure? Yeah. When it doesn't have to be done in 10 days, you know, that sort of thing. So the idea that we can be experimenting and learning from real life, I think that's very valuable right now.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that because I always tell the story, and sorry for people that have heard it a million times. Literally, kind of like a week before the first lockdown, I spoke to a CHRO who said, "Oh, Chris, we've got this, you know, 3 to 5 year plan to move our call center staff remote. And I was like, 3 to 5 years? Yeah, you know, there's like, you know, 20,000 call center staff. It's going to take us a long time. They did it in like 2 days. And we had a call a few months later where we were both laughing about it because it was like, you had a 3 to 5 year plan and you did it in a few days. And it's because all of that red tape just disappeared.
Right.
All those IT security concerns disappeared. All of the, everything disappeared. We obviously had no choice, but to your point, imagine if we could do that when we don't have a pandemic, we don't have a war to deal with, right? And we could be more experimental and understand that we're not going to get it right. We are going to fail. And that's okay. That's actually what we want in many ways, because we learn how not to do things and what works best as well. So yeah, I love that insight.
Yeah. So if I can give you sort of a companion piece to that. Now is the time to start a practice where 4 times a year, maybe that's too much for your organization, twice a year, you say, what could be even better than it is today? And pick a time. Let's take your 3 to 5 year horizon, because that's a classic. That's just perfect. If we could do the best possible thing in 5 years, best possible thing for customers, best possible thing for the environment, best possible thing for use of technology, best whatever it is, what would that look like? How would we work back from that? So what could we do tomorrow? Now, what could we do tomorrow to actually get us closer to that than we've ever thought we could be? Because we can do it in 9 months, 12 months, doesn't have to be 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. One of the things I ask my friends and myself, to be honest, personally, is if you knew that you couldn't fail, what would you do?
Yeah.
And it creates a different, because most of the time we put these like timelines or these limitations on ourselves, but just asking yourself or another person, you know, if you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? And some of the responses I've gotten from my team members and my family and even my wife, we've done it immediately.
That's fantastic.
And it's like, because a lot of time our beliefs are unfounded or it's kind of a lack of confidence perhaps, you know, which is really all that's getting in the way. So just kind of switching the question, similar to your point, right, of what you're doing is fascinating what we can do and what we can achieve.
Right,
As well, yeah.
And exactly,
I did it in my WhatsApp group with all of my friends that I grew up with, who I don't really speak to as much. And many of them are still working in, the vast majority of actually are working in jobs that they don't like. That they're just in because they need to pay the bills, and which is the majority of people, unfortunately, from my experience, that's what I speak to. And their answers of what they would do with like different careers and stuff like that were just very super achievable. Like they weren't like blue sky thinking, I'm going to go build a base on Mars. Like it was like really realistic stuff that they had this limiting belief they would just never be able to do it. And it really opened my eyes. I was like, wow, like you can do all of those things as well. So yeah, it's interesting.
Can I take what you said about your friend group in a different direction?
Sure.
One of the things that we also saw during the pandemic, people are really creative. I mean, it's true that the creativity goes in waves. You know, here in the States, baking sourdough bread was a big thing for loads of people. Or, you know, whatever it was, building terraria.
I love that. An example, by the way.
All different kinds of things. But what we saw is that not everybody gets their ego satisfaction from their work. They often get it from other things. That's totally legit. What's really crummy is if you're not getting it anywhere. And that's part of why the attention to the hybrid situation and the flexibility is so important. Because if people aren't feeling satisfied by their lives, either they have to leave you and change their lives, or they get worse and worse. You know, if they're held down by their lives, how fantastic can they possibly be in their jobs?
I love that. I never thought about it like that before, because that's a really interesting insight, because you're right. Some of those people that I'm referring to, outside of their job, they have these passions that they love. So they will, so they'll put up with the job.
Yes.
Because it allows them to fulfill other elements of their life. I never even thought about it that way, because I kind of do it on both ends. I'm very lucky, feel very privileged to be able to do that. But if you then take that away from them, they're going to leave, or they're going to get worse and worse, like you're saying. I never even thought about it from that perspective. And for many people, they found that joy over the last 2 years.
Yes.
Right? Whether it's the fact that I get to spend more time with my daughter and pick her up from nursery. And now, and for me, that's, for example, that's a non-negotiable. I can now do that. And I'm not, you know, I would never go and work for a company ever again, even if I sold this company and went for work for, I would never, if you said to me, I can't go and pick up my daughter from nursery and be there when I want to be there for her, then it's just no, the answer is no. And other people found different hobbies, right? And passions throughout that as well. So yeah, really interesting insight. I didn't even think about it from that perspective of where people get draw energy from.
Yeah, and you see it in the side gigs, all of that.
All of that stuff, yeah.
So it will not work. We are in a major transitional shift. It has only started. It will not work in the long term for leaders not to recognize that these are full human beings who are doing the jobs.
Yeah. Well, look, Liz, I feel like I can talk to you forever, but I've got to end this at some point. I feel like I need a part two of this. But honestly, genuinely really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you so much. Before I let you go, if there's sort of a parting message you would give to HR, you know, what would that be? And then where can people connect with you? If they want to reach out to you, work with you, check out all of your blog and everything else, where's the best place?
Thank you so much. Let's take the HR thing first. Learn the business and learn the leaders. Make sure you understand how the business makes its money and what it takes to do that. The more connected you are to the actual sausage making, of course, you have to keep yourself separate so that you can be dispassionate about it, but you really have to understand the mechanisms and the guts, because then you can target your work toward making the case that the leaders will understand and appreciate, instead of having them think of you as just protections for certain kinds of things or just administrative. That would be my HR stance. And thank you. In terms of my work, the best place to find me is actually on my website, which is lizkislick.com, LizKislik, because I've got at least 10 years of writing there of all kinds of stuff. And you can get my newsletter and my blogs. And there's also a free ebook that some of your audience may be interested in, Chris, about the interpersonal aspects of conflict at work and how to improve those. And of course, LinkedIn is fabulous. And I also post on Twitter a bunch.
Yeah. No, I absolutely love it. And for everyone listening, as always, those links are already below. So make sure you go check them out. Follow Liz on LinkedIn as well. And I was going to get into some of that, into that conflict stuff, the work that you're talking about. We don't have time today, but you could download it on Liz's website as well. Reach out to Liz. But no, it was a real pleasure. And I look forward to doing this again soon. But thanks again. I appreciate
it. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.